Hello and welcome to the Creating Crowbar episode 85, being recorded on the 24th of March. I'm Marsh Davis. I'm joined this week by Graham Smith.
Hello.
Chris Thurston.
Hi.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
Gentlemen, you join me here in the week that shall henceforth be known as International Miyazaki Week. In 1,000 years time, when your great, great, double great, multi great, monster great grandchildren ask you, or rather the floating sentient orb which you now are, where were you in the before times, in the not now, when Bloodborne, the greatest game of all time, was launched? What would you say to them?
I was reading about it on Twitter.
Yeah, Twitter. Everybody's going to say Twitter.
Yeah,
that's unfortunately the answer.
Cursing America, because it's not out here until fucking Friday. I'm furious. And just impotent fury. And like a baby. the rattle is just out of reach.
And that's children, I'll say, is how the great Second War of Independence started.
Yeah. We're not going to talk about Bloodborne on this podcast, though. However, at the request of our listeners, and mostly at the request of ourselves, we will be dedicating a special non-PC-related podcast to talk about Bloodborne and Bloodborne alone. So look out for that in the coming weeks.
There is a petition, because of course there's a petition, because there's a petition for everything now.
Hmm.
You can petition to get anything you want on the internet. And you might not get it. But they have petitioned to get Bloodborne on PC.
Well, that's not going
to
happen, isn't it? It's a first-party Sony game made for their console, which they own and want to sell.
You've answered the question I was subsequently going to ask, so let's leave it there.
Oh, okay.
The wording of it was, the petition is that, you have betrayed us. The betrayal, you've betrayed us by releasing a product in a different way than we're used to you releasing it.
Yeah, that is the tone of voice that you have to adopt if you're a fan of gaming on the PC. You're not allowed to be magnanimous or understanding of someone else's business model. It has to be expressed with a tone, like you're a kind of a warlike island nation that has been crossed for the last time. Like, everything is on the verge of Agincourt, basically. And that's
it does hurt me. It is sad to me personally that it's not out on PC, although I do recognise the Cosmos probably doesn't owe me this. But, you know, I'd like to play it on PC, not just because you could run it at a higher frame rate, which I probably won't notice, because I didn't notice when I was playing it at the weekend on a PS4, but mostly because I'd like to be able to play it on my own in my room, rather than negotiate what is usually a communal space, which is where the consoles reside. Yeah, I don't know.
Yep, you're going to have to give me lots of little shiny pennies for goes on the PlayStation.
Yeah. Anyway, enough of non-PC gaming talk. What have you guys been playing this week, Tom Senior?
Been playing Pillars of Eternity, which when this podcast is out, I will be allowed to talk about, because it will be out, and everyone could buy it, and you should buy it, because it's great. I like it a lot. It's a rehash of old Infinity Engine RPGs, the old, ye olde Baldur's Gates, Planescape Torments, but in a beautiful new engine. With what I personally love about it is the combat system. But Chris has also been playing it.
I have. It's it's also the sort of the end of something we started talking about years and years and years and years ago on the prior podcast, which is Kickstarter. Is it ever going to make a whole good game, or just an episodic thing, or something bad? And this is a whole good game that, from what I've played of it, about 15 hours.
Feels polished, it feels like a real game that you'd buy and be happy about.
It's really long. And, like, the other thing is, I keep playing it, and I go to, like, the end of Act 1, where it sort of opens up a bit, and then it opens up more and more, and it opens up more stuff. Mm. And I kept expecting it to stop, because of the nature of its business model, because it was crowdfunded. Mm. I sort of assumed that you're going to get a little sign that pops up and go, oh, we'll finish this bit later. You know what I mean? Like, or I don't know, it's an episodic structure, or, Act 3 coming in, November 2015 or something. Because crowdfunding has trained me to be disappointed. Mm. But it's not disappointing, which, the fact that that's a surprise at all.
Can you take me through the basic bullet points of the game? Because it's merged in my mind with all the other Kickstarter RPGs, old school RPGs that were kickstarted. Which one is this?
This is the Infinity Engine one, like Tom said. Like, this is the Baldur's Gate of
that. So it's kind of fantasy world setting?
Yeah. It's set in a new fantasy setting with a new rule set. Like, obviously, Baldur's Gate and Icewind Dale were both spun out of D&D, whereas this is a new system that they've devised from scratch, which is quite a lot like D&D in some ways, but and like old... do you pronounce it Thaco or Thac Zero? I've never really known.
I always call it Thaco.
I would thought Thaco as well. Mm. But I've never actually had to pronounce it, which is like that particular rule set in that era of... of I don't know what edition of D&D it was, but...
what does that stand for?
I don't know, but it's what people say when they want to sound smart about that kind of game, Marsh.
Okay, well, I
Do you like rolling D20s?
I do.
Play some Thaco.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. You have to do the Thaco, and then... But, yeah, so it's got its own analogous combat system, which fixes a lot of D&D's problems. Like, we could sort of... I mean, Tom, the combat system is what you've really pulled out liking about it. What do you like about it so much?
It does just remove, like, just a whole ton of the bullshit that was just attached to D&D. Like, it's all about dice rolling, essentially. But, Baldur's Gate always exposed the dice rolling. Even in the way that you created characters. Like, you'd roll a character, then click the reroll button over and over and over again until you happen to get a good roll. Which is just building in pointless redundancy into a system. And that's just a small example of one of the many things they've gotten rid of throughout the entire combat system. So when it comes to, like, learning spells, instead of just this idea of kind of memorizing things overnight and then having them appear, you pick up grimoires, and the grimoires have spells you don't know, and then you click on them and you learn them. And then, like, the next time you wake up, they're in, you can just use them, and it's fine. And it's just clarified a load of the stuff about... So in D&D, there's stuff about daily abilities that you can only use once a day, and then per-encounter abilities, and they've just clarified loads of stuff about that. Like, it's just very easy, by just mousing over an ability, to know whether it's an encounter ability or a daily ability. And the roles are very well defined, and tanks work brilliantly. They've got a great disengagement system, where if a character is engaged in melee combat, they can't leave that combat if they're toe-to-toe without taking a free hit.
Hmm.
And it takes time and it stalls them. And that just, like, realises what that character, that tanky character, is completely for, and it turns the battlefield into a tactical space that you're constantly looking at, like, formations, where your people are, where your range damage dealers are in relation to your line, your front line that you create, and your, like, there are these, I've had just countless brilliantly tactical encounters where I've seen enemies up ahead and knowing, I've known this is going to be a fight. So I've had my, one of my guys stealth and lay traps and then back off and then, you know, shoot one of them, they come charging through the traps. And then, you customize your formation, so I've got my three fighters at the front, and they've got, like, a mage and a priest, and I've got a fucking lion, my ranger's got a lion that stands on the front line and just fucks people up and roars every now and then to make them scared. And they hit that, and then I counterattack with massive spells. And as soon as they're all bound up with the tanks, I send, like, a wizard around the side, because friendly fire is always on. There's this tactical consideration about where you're gonna let off those spells, these incredibly powerful, high damage abilities, like fireballs and lightning bolts. And it's not just about, it's not a massive power trip, in the way that, like, so many RPGs have become. You know, like, just press all the buttons and let off these amazing things and it looks beautiful, but you don't have to think about anything. Like, Pillars of Eternity is the opposite of that. You're always thinking about how you're using your power. You are powerful, but you have to be powerful in a very directed way that makes combat really satisfying.
Hmm. They have done something that I hope everybody who is remastering an old type of game, beloved old-school PC game, takes to heart, which is they have preserved the tactical depth of that old system, why people love Dicewind Dale particularly, which is a game that was far more combat focused than story, like, but they have done so while adding, like, quality of life and convenience stuff that makes the game more pleasant to play. And what I mean by that is, like, if you play Baldur's Gate now, there's tons of stuff about that game, it's just a pain in the ass. And there's a subset of the community that, of the gaming community that, you know, will get upset if you remove the pain in the ass stuff, because they'll assume that the whole thing has been simplified. And that would be really unfair to apply it to Pillars of Eternity. An example in Pillars of Eternity is you have fucking shitloads of inventory space. Every single one of your party members can carry loads of stuff. And then you have, like, a mutual stash, which I've never ever managed to fill it up.
No.
Like, you just, and there's no, like, weight considerations. You can carry shitloads of stuff.
Hmm.
And that, you know, maybe that dents the simulation nature, because this is back when RPGs had a strong simulation aspect to them in terms of time and everything else.
Hmm.
But it makes the game much more pleasant to play, because it removes the one thing that you do in every RPG ever, which is, oh, I've done this, oh, I've got to choose whether I want this buckler that's worth 8 gold, or the rusty iron sword I just found that's worth 9. And you know what I mean? It removes the faff really subtly, in a way that little things like that. There's tons of little kind of convenience things that are really, really nice to have. And the daily spells is another one where you kind of instantly know, like, what you've got available to you in a given time. It also does a whole bunch of things with, like, how health works that I really like. So it still has... The game takes place in its version of real time. You still have to rest. Time progresses for your characters at a steady pace. It never skips. So, you know, I'm currently 14 days into the adventure, and that's variable. And this is not a spoiler. Basically, the end of the opening of the game, you get access to a stronghold, which is yours. And it's in ruins, and there's all sorts of buildings and stuff you can build in there. And then you get a kind of management game that build on top of it, where you can send party members that aren't currently in your party off on adventures that take real time.
Hmm.
So they can gain XP and do things while you're not around. Which is, I'm trying to think of an analogy for that. A bit like, I suppose a Dragon Age Inquisition has a similar system with the war table, but it is more granular in that it's literally characters you're not using can go off and do things for you.
It sounds almost exactly like the thing the last World of Warcraft expansion added. I can't remember what they
garrisons.
Call it. Garrisons.
Yeah, similar to that, actually. But those upgrades take... when I say real time, I don't mean what happens in like World of Warcraft or Inquisition, where it's actually like you log off and it happens while you're logged off. It happens in... Like, you know, they say that, you know, repairing the Western Barbican is going to take 2 days. And so it's, you know, on your character, you go off and you walk across the landscape and time progresses and it takes 8 hours to walk from one place to another place. And then 2 days in your character's life later, it's done. And that sort of level of granularity ties into resting and when you should recover and when you get your spells back, which gives it an air of verisimilitude that people love those old games for, because it doesn't do the kind of, like, you know, the thing BioWare games traditionally really struggle with, which is giving you a sense of your character's kind of contiguous experience, because you're constantly leaping between huge events in that character's life without really any sense of how long it takes them to travel places. Mm. Like, you know, try and figure out how long it takes the Normandy to get places in Mass Effect. You know, you don't really have that strong sense of what it's like to be on that ship. Whereas in this you do. But the way that kind of, like, that's a nice system from the past, but it's been tied into a really cool new idea about how, like, health works, which gives you a sense that when you rest, it is kind of more of a significant thing. And the way that works is you have health for every character and endurance. And health is a value that is depleted when you take certain attacks, that if you run out of, your character is dead. And if it's a companion, there is a setting that allows them to be maimed the first time that they run out. But if you are playing in a mode where you're not going to let yourself save scum, if you're not going to load a save, that character's gone. Doesn't matter if it's a bot companion. If you lose your main character, the game is over. But if you lose anyone else, game continues. That person is dead now. Gone. Huh. However, that's not your main health bar. Your main health bar is called endurance, and that's available on an encounter-by-encounter basis, and you can take wounds that dent your max endurance, but basically you're not incapacitated in a fight until you run out of endurance. And so what that means is you get in this cool situation where your characters will be all quite low on health, which means they're kind of like close to death in a more general sense, but they have... you know, a full bar of endurance that regenerates every fight. So you can take the chance on fighting, even though it's a higher risk, but you're not kind of, just because you're walking around on low health doesn't mean you have to rest right now, which is the kind of traditional Baldur's Gate Infinity Engine thing of, like, doing a dungeon by sleeping for 8 hours in every single corridor.
Yeah, they limit that cleverly by, like, it's a supply resource now, so you've got 4 campsites. Bits of equipment that you can set up so you can rest 4 times. Hmm. So you get this attritional element to dungeons where you're going, like, especially the really big ones, there's like an epic 15-hour one, which is like incredibly deep and long underneath your stronghold.
Yeah.
And it's about attrition and about using, like, choosing when to rest and when not to rest in a dungeon is actually a significant decision now. Like, you can have 1 or 2 characters that are important that are really low on health, and you just don't want to lose your wizard who's fucking amazing. So, you know, do you just, you can play battles and keep them at the back. Or just, like, as Chris was saying, just have him in a different room.
Because, like, I had a moment where I've been trained by RPGs since those days to sort of assume that my party moves as a unit and they do everything together, because, you know, most RPGs now, when they have a party system, you're not micromanaging every single character. You're kind of controlling the group, or maybe you switch between characters and the AI takes over the ones you're not controlling. That's not the case at all. It's completely micromanagement. And the AI does nothing if you don't tell it to.
Hmm.
So if you have 6 characters in your party, and it's up to you how many you take with you, then you have to be ready to micromanage all of them. And I had a situation where my main character's a wizard. I have another wizard, 2 wizards, correct number of wizards, full third of the party is wizards. And they were both really wounded. And bizarrely, so they had loads of wounds and loads of no health. So they basically, if a gnat farted on them, either of them would just die outright. And I was, initially, I was just stuck in a bad habit that games recently taught me, which is that I had to... I still had to take them with me. And I just had to try and, like, you know, keep retrying the same fights until I found the one where the AI didn't happen to aggro them even slightly. And then I realized, I'm being an idiot. This is like an old school RPG where it's kind of a sim. I can just leave them somewhere else. And so my two wizards just went and hung out while my other four members of my party went off and cleared the next couple of rooms. Because they weren't in any danger if they just waited around the corner in a room we'd already cleared. And I didn't need them necessarily. So you could sort of, like, that, like, degree of freedom, which is what reminds me more of pen and paper, where it's, you know, which is the roots of this thing, where you have the freedom to try a solution that's more interesting, or I guess the point of all the resting and the wounding system is that it just creates interesting strategic decisions. Like, do you continue to press your luck? You know, when and where do you choose to kind of, like, hedge your bets with resources and things? And that's just a kind of degree of interest that you haven't done.
I think a sign of the quality of the combat and progression systems is that I've never felt underleveled yet. I've always lost because there's been a structural problem with my party. It's like, I can't do this fight because I just don't have the healing, or I don't have the kind of required elements that would allow me to survive or do enough damage, or I don't have the armor penetration because these guys are really heavily armored. And that stuff is fixable. You can hire heroes from any pub you go into. So you're not tied to companions in the way that you would be in a bio RPG. You could just go and create a character. If you say, you decide, I need a rogue who can get around and do loads of armor penetration damage, you just make one. And you could bank these heroes as you go along and level them up, you know, as well. In fact, you don't even earn experience for killing monsters in Pillars of Eternity. You only earn experience by completing tasks, discovering areas, completing quests, and that kind of thing. Because it's so confident in the fact that your skill can overcome statistical gaps that it doesn't force the issue, doesn't force you to have a certain level most of the time. Like, there are some areas where you go in, there'll just be like a super powerful fucking wither in there, and you're not going to stand a chance. But it's immediately apparent, it's like, okay, can't take that yet. Got to come back when I've got the right stuff. But, you know, for the most part, like, it's got a really flexible kind of difficulty gap between you and your opponents.
Like, there's a debate currently on the game subreddit about whether or not the no XP for kills is, again, a huge simplification or a kind of betrayal of its values. And I really don't think it is. I think it's an improvement. Because what this does is it opens up loads of room for, like, different playstyles that remain viable. If kills are a really important source of XP, then you can't really have the story where the hero sneaks through the dungeon and then fights the boss, because he'll sneak through the dungeon, but then you won't have enough XP to kill the boss, and then he'll die. So what this allows you to do, because you get a flat amount of XP basically for finishing the dungeon however you do it, you know, sometimes that leads to an anticlimax where you just kind of, like, slip in and out and you're done. But you should need the right to have that in order to have the more interesting stories as well. And it means that the decision to kill everything is a more interesting decision. Like, we're always talking about people not making the decision to kill stuff interesting. Like, you don't kill stuff in Pillars of Eternity because you have to. Most of the time. Obviously, you get attacked and stuff, but the decision to, I'm going to clear every room in this dungeon, is actually a decision you're making for your characters, not a decision the game is pushing on.
It also completely ruins the player's ability to ruin the game for themselves by grinding, which is what happens so often in RPGs where, you know, if you could just kill things to become more powerful. Instead, it makes you think about how to become more powerful by doing the quests and playing the game, or thinking about your, you know, unit setup and who to hire and stuff. You can't just go into a field and kill boars for 5 hours and then come back and do it. Like, you've got to think about it. You've got to play it. You've got to go and engage with the game in a more interesting way. It's just loads of smart design decisions that just fix that genre in many ways.
I sort of assumed this would be a game where the combat would be kind of gash, and what was interesting about it was the story and the world and the characters and stuff. Is it written well?
Yeah. I mean, it's Forgotten Realms, but legally not Forgotten Realms. And it's kind of fun.
Forgotten Realms.
Yeah. It's the Forgotten Realms. And it's kind of, I think it's fine. It's inoffensive, I think. Like, I haven't found anything really super interesting about the lore that's made me care about it a lot, but maybe I'm still, like, about 20 hours in, like, there's time to...
I wouldn't say I found anything I think it's well written, and I mean that in a technical sense. Like, it's written by people who have a lot of experience writing this stuff, and can do so dexterously and effectively, and, I mean, it's you know, we described it in the office as sonorous whiffle a lot of the time. And there's a degree of that, but there are interesting... The voice acting is pretty bad. That's the only real problem with the narrative is it sounds a lot like Baldur's Gate did, in terms of, like, you know, actors sort of repeating the same line of like, welcome to my inn. And they say that like every time you click on them, and it's got that kind of thing to it. And a lot of dialogue is fully voiced, and that's often the stuff you want to stop because it's better when it's in your mind's ear. But I really like the writing for the most part. Like, as Tom says, the setting is fairly standard fantasy, but it has one conceit. A couple of conceits that make it interesting. Like, I don't think you need to put, like, you don't need to, like, go full Planescape to make fantasy interesting. You just, you know, like, where, by which I mean, you know, go full, like, multiverse kind of anything goes to kind of introduce new ideas to fantasy. Its thing is that, and this is not a spoiler because it's first half hour of the game, is that souls are kind of a scientific principle in Pillars of Eternity. They're not even really considered by most of the characters you meet to be magic. They're just a kind of like a kind of a property of a sentient being that they know, that people in the world know how to kind of manipulate and track and measure and find. And everyone in the world basically reincarnates when they die. So it's almost got like a Buddhist cycle of life thing, where when you die, your soul, because it's just matter, basically, or energy, it goes back into the system and it comes out somewhere else. You might not have any memories or whatever, but it plays a lot with that idea about characters who do remember, or like past lives resurfacing in existing characters and stuff like that. And that's the thing that links everything together. And the game, and that is quite Planescape-y in terms of having themes of like looking, staring directly into the past and seeing echoes of former lives and stuff. And it uses that to give you information that you wouldn't be able to get access to. And the other thing it does is it's basically how they've ended up rewarding Kickstarter backers is at a certain tier of backer, you could have a character in the game. And so what they did is they got people to design characters, I think in an app that they put out early, like a character creation tool. And those characters are in the game now with like gold names. And if you, when you click on them, you get a vision of either a previous event in this character's life or something about the soul that's currently a resident in this body. So, and all of these are basically like two or three paragraph fantasy vignettes. You don't, it's all completely optional. None of it ties into the main plot, but it's just there to flesh out the world if you want it. And you'll sometimes be like three or four of these characters standing in a circle, and you can click on all of them and get, you know, four mini fantasy short stories or just little kind of things. And there's fucking hundreds of these. Like, the writing task that represents is phenomenal, but that's kind of one of the reasons. And that stuff is all well-written. Like, it's well-written fantasy. So, you know, you're unlikely to have a revelation or discover something you never knew about yourself by reading a cool little vignette about some pirates. But there's a cool little vignette about some pirates in there. So I think on that level, like, the narrative is a success. It's just, I don't know, the game narratives get judged on different levels, I guess. It's not going to, it's not Bioware, right? Like, it's not all emotion all the time. But nor is it like dead dry, or I wouldn't say I had nothing to say either.
Do you go to cool places? Do you visit cool cities, or is it all just like Triad Fantasy, medieval?
I don't know, I'm not far enough into it. I have a feeling it will go to some places.
It's also not medieval fantasy, really. It's closer to Renaissance in terms of the architecture, and there are firearms. That's the guns are the counter to wizards. Go through magical shields, so that they are literally the counter to. That's why they in the lore. That's why people invented firearms to kill.
Really satisfying as well.
To kill wizards, because and there's like a story you get told very early in the game about an uprising that happened, and it was led by someone who's claiming to be the reincarnation of a god, and it led to this sort of like civil war. And it ended, and you keep hearing like, because it does use like big fantasy fucking capital letter terms that it doesn't explain to you for ages, and because everyone just knows what they are. And a character's like, oh well, that war ended with the Godhammer, and we know this, the rebellion was crushed by the Godhammer. And you kind of, reading a lot of fantasy, you kind of expect that's going to be, and this isn't a spoiler again, very early in the game, you expect that's going to be like a magical spell or like, you know, a dragon or a kind of a fantasy thing. It's just a really big fucking bomb. They just blew up God, basically, because, and that kind of like nice little kind of, occasionally you get characters kind of like angrily insisting that the thing they do that win any of the fantasy setting would be necromancy. That's science. That's full on science, and because it all involves the transfer of matter and energy and stuff. So there is stuff in there that's
uses text very well. Actually, uses prose very well, and it's like a big, like, expect to read a lot of stuff going into it. Like, there are, it uses text that got a multiple choice adventure segments to let you zoom in on the world in a way that isn't possible in that engine. from that perspective, you know, from that floating top-down perspective. It lets you, like, it opens up a kind of scroll, and on the scroll it'll be a passage like, you know, you click on some vines and it'll say, you know, these vines look tough and climbable, and it'll ask if you want to climb them. Then it'll roll a kind of dexterity check. It's very pen and papery in that way. And then that will affect the outcome, and, like, some of you might take some damage by going to the top because you've kind of, like, they've fallen down and come back up. And then, you know, it resolves it and you go to the top of the tower. But instead of, like, a, you know, the alternative is a shitty animation where you just watch a tiny man climb up some vines for ages. So what they've done is they've given you a close look at that world that wouldn't otherwise be possible in that engine.
It's also with pencil art as well. So it just, like, takes over the screen, and it'll, like, basically they use pencil art and twine to do what in another game would be a quick time event. But with different sort of routes through or...
And skill checks. Things that actually check against
you. Oh, yeah, for sure. It's not just press a button on time.
Yeah, and there are loads of conversation options that tie into your skill set as well. The stats that you choose really open up different conversation options and different ways of resolving situations.
We were talking about... So, like, one of the great best things, like, so I'm playing it, Tom's playing it, and Andy Kelly's been reviewing it for PC Gamer. And we've had a lot of conversations in the office about it, and within, like, maybe 2 or 3 hours of starting, we all had stories about how we'd approach things, even though, you know, it's relatively linear, like any RPG from that era would be. We encountered the same stuff, but, like, decisions we'd made in character creation or just decisions we'd made, period, like, had generated stories straight away. It wasn't just, oh, do you remember this bit? Mm. It was like, you know, there was a bit where we're doing one of those choose-your-own-adventure bits, and a guy had fallen behind and was getting jumped on by an evil attacker, and I had the option to, because I'm a wizard, to, like, throw a bottle of magic to save him, and other characters don't have that, and that led to a different series of outcomes, and we were kind of already talking about that, which is really cool. And, like, I love the character creation system as well, because it doesn't just get you to pick, like, a race and a class, stuff like that. You pick, to quite a fine level of detail, backstory things about who you are and where you're from. So you're not just a human, and you're not just a human from a particular area of the world, you're a human of a particular class, a particular set of motivations, blah, 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 and all that stuff colours the options you get to talk about and stuff like that.
It's just a really fucking good RPG.
Yeah.
Basically, does all the things that, you know, RPGs once remembered for being great for.
I will probably not play it yet.
Yeah.
I'd love to see you play it, Marshall. I think you'd find it objectionable in some ways.
Oh, really?
And I'd love to see what you think about it.
All right, maybe I will. Graham, what have you been playing?
I've been playing City Skylines. Skylines? Skylines?
Skylines.
Plural.
Cities Skylines.
Yeah, it's a really bad name for a video game. But but it's basically, it's SimCity. And in a almost to a freakish degree, they have just made SimCity, but didn't do all the stupid things that people hated that EA did with the last SimCity game. So it's a general focus city building game. You place down roads, you zone commercial districts and industry and residential, but you have much more space to do so than in the last SimCity game. You've got a huge amount of space, in fact. I assumed that there was technical constraints that wouldn't make that possible when it was 3D and real simulated and stuff like that. And I know that their simulation's simpler in a bunch of different ways than SimCity, but it's still fucking massive. And it's not always online. In which case, this is great! and it's like, I've loved all the older SimCity games, and the thing that they do really well is, your city is never in a position of stasis. You're constantly balancing different parts of it because you build a little bit of extra commercial and suddenly your need for residential and industry goes up because these essentially three factions are all feeding into each other and all require one another. Or, you know, similarly, you expand into a new area, but that means that your road network is now all fucked up because you're getting greater traffic problems. So at any given point, you have 8 different things that are calling for your attention that you know are kind of, I could make that a little bit better if I just went in and I took these variables and I changed the taxes and I knocked some stuff down over here. And SimCity was always really well balanced in that regard, so that you never got to a point in the older SimCity games, like SimCity 4 and before, where you felt like, it's good enough, I'm done. It always felt like there was something popping up that needed your attention. And this has that, but is much less refined in the way that it does it? And that's the kind of thing. Like there's a layer of Maxis polish or EA polish that the SimCity games had that this absolutely doesn't have. Presumably because it's made by a much smaller team and a much lower budget. I mean, it's published by Paradox. It's made by a company called Colossal Order, who've only ever done a couple of transport tycoon-y games called Cities in Motion before. Mm. Neither of which were really very good. They were kind of like solid, interesting 65%-y kind of games with lots of bugs. Whereas this doesn't have bugs, but like the interface is kind of shonky and it does a pretty poor job, I think, of like communicating to you sometimes what it is your city actually needs. The way it tries to do it, it's like it doesn't have advisors and it doesn't have as good kind of data overlays as the last SimCity game does. It has a fake Twitter client where members of your city, you can read their tweets as they celebrate about your smoke detector policy and that sort of stuff. And
are they as insightful as normal Twitterites are in when replying to their politicians?
Yes.
Do they harass each other?
They don't harass each other, but they are as insightful as regular Twitterites, which means it's just fucking annoying and a little bit useless. But at the same time, it, despite being, I feel, like, less nuanced or less refined in these mechanics, it still just apes SimCity enough that I played it at the weekend, and I started playing it, and suddenly 8 hours had gone by, and I was still playing it. It's got that time sink element, and it's been a long time since I've encountered that really in any game, let alone a game of that sort.
Do you think that there will be another SimCity game?
Yes. Because the last one sold, I don't know, something like 6 million copies, and sold well, yeah, and pretty quickly as well. I think it sold a few million in its first month.
Because Maxis is dead now, isn't it?
Yeah. That part of Maxis is, yeah.
I thought the entire company had been
Maxis
dissolved.
Is gone, yeah, but
The Sims team was absorbed into EA.
Yeah, long ago, EA Sims label or something like that was called was established for before. Like around about the time of The Sims 2, I think.
Okay, well, they're still called Maxis, though.
Oh, really?
I've been to their office a couple of times. It's Maxis in huge letters.
Okay, maybe they changed the name, because for a while they were called EA Sims.
I'm pretty sure this happened in the last few weeks. It went
Sure that Maxis Emeryville closed down, but not the one in the EA campus.
It's all probably meaningless anyway, because even if they closed them down, that might just mean that they've changed their name and shuffled their staff around to a different EA office.
I don't know, but I do know there
are two Maxis.
The original Maxis was closed down. So, like, the office they started in, which was the Emeryville one, and the staff there were told that they could move elsewhere with NEA if they wanted to, but that presumably means moving hundreds of miles to go to another part of California, which isn't suitable for everyone. But certainly, what you're describing was called EA Sims for a while, so I wonder if they rebranded it as Maxis a few years ago or something.
Maybe. I mean, my awareness was there were two Maxis. There was the one...
Maybe Maxis is the plural, and it's actually always been just Maxi. Maxon. Then they opened another one, and it became Maxis.
Maxon, maybe. There were two Maxon, one in the ES campus in Silicon Valley, which was where The Sims is made. And I never saw it ever threatened anything other than Maxis, and that was true a couple of years ago.
Anyway, so presumably they still have like teams working on it at EA then?
I would think probably like the last SimCity is probably done with because it didn't get a great critical reception, and I don't think the expansion did particularly great, Cities of Tomorrow, because it wasn't very good. But yeah, they're going to make more SimCity games. They'd be mad not to because it makes an awful lot of money, and certainly The Sims still makes an awful lot of money, so they're going to keep making those. Mm-hmm. There's definitely going to be new Cities Skylines games because it's already sold 500,000 copies.
Wow.
And is the fastest selling Paradox game ever, and when I looked like 3 or 4 days ago was still the top of the Steam charts, like in terms of best selling at that given moment.
Cool.
So it's doing really well, which is exciting as well, because lots of this stuff that's janky about it is things that they could fix with more money and time, and Paradox have a really good record for free updates, decent bits of DLC and expansion packs for their games.
Did you find that the way it's structured, and this is a problem with SimCity as well, incentivized you to build a very specific sort of city, just a big standard grid from which, if you were to deviate from that, would make you, you'll seem more inefficient. We were talking about this a few podcasts ago. I was wondering if you'd experience that anxiety.
Not really. Like, I had that in SimCity, the last one. Oh, God, I really wish they would have named it SimCity 5. Yeah, I'm not talking about... Anytime I say SimCity, I'm not talking about the one that was released in 1989. But in SimCity, I had that because you had such a small amount of space. So they made a big deal out of the fact that, hey, now you can have curved roads, but you never wanted to use curved roads because if you did that, that was idiotic. But... In City Skylines, you've got so much space to build within. I don't mind using curved roads and maybe losing a little bit of space for buildings. And I found that the system for zoning is kind of good enough that even with curved roads, you can jam a lot of buildings in. You don't feel like you're ending up with a bunch of empty spaces in between buildings or using spaces inefficiently.
Yeah.
I certainly... regret times where I've used like one-way roads and then realized like an hour and a half later that I've completely fucked up my entire road network because of that. But then that's part of the fun, I think, of city building games. Mm. And it is a problem that SimCity didn't incentivize that enough.
Is there a game out there which doesn't let you build a city from, you know, just a plain, like an empty field, but actually has like an organically grown city that you then have to massage into better function?
The boss game.
I don't know if City Skylines does this, but certainly all the older SimCity games came with a bunch of prepackaged, pre-built cities.
You know? Oh, but I'm not looking for a good city. I'm looking for something which is inefficient, but organic, the way that cities are when city planners, as they are now known in modernity, come to them.
Well, that's what these were meant to be. These were specific scenarios where it was like, here is a replica of New York, built as closely as you could using SimCity sprites, but it's fucked in some way. You know, go and manage it and see if you can fix it and maintain the budget while doing so. But the way, actually, I've been playing City Skylines is almost the complete opposite of that, in that you can just turn on cheats. So I just gave myself... I played it properly for 5 or 6 hours, and I just went into the menu and started a new game with infinite money and just bought all 9 territories and then got a mod that allows you to buy all 12 territories, because that's the way it works. You start off with an area which is a little bit bigger, I wonder if that's on purpose, a little bit bigger than the full city you can have in SimCity, but that's just one of 9 segments of this land that you can purchase to essentially expand your city's border, but you're buying 9 squares out of a 12 square grid, I think it is, so you're just kind of constantly growing it out, and so I did that and just bought up all the land and then built a fucking massive metropolis.
Is there any kind of geographical sculpting? Can you change the landscape, add rivers and stuff?
No, much like the last SimCity game, you can't edit the landscape at all. It does have stuff like...
Because that's the most interesting thing about city building, is because it's always limited by the topology of the landscape around... build it in a desert like Mass Vegas.
You have to take into account the terrain because, I mean... For example, the map I'm playing on at the moment has islands, and so I'm having to deal with bridges and connecting them up so that people can travel around. It's also got a distribution of natural resources, so fertile land, oil, ore, and trees, I think. And so you want to make sure that your oil industry is where there is the most oil in the ground, and that changes the way that you want to build stuff.
It's like when you get rid of your, you know, sewage, it's going to go out into a river, but also, you know, you're pulling water out of that river, and so you want to check which direction the water's flowing so that you're not just pumping shit up into your own your own water supply, which is a press event Fraser Brown did on intentionally to create Poo Town. Don't do that.
Apparently, I haven't messed around with this, but apparently you can build dams and actually block the flow of water and actually make areas that were previously underwater dry by building a dam. Oh, so yeah. I suppose that's...
I thought you were going to just turn a city into a giant cesspit by blocking all the sewers.
Well, someone did a thing where they built a dam, blocked up all the water, built a giant city where the water used to be, filled up the dammed water with... slimy sewage poo water and then destroyed the dam and the water floods through it.
Amazing.
I saw that in Image Hero earlier today.
Yeah, I don't think I saw that episode of Boss. So I'm probably having a hallucination at the time.
God, I want to play the game. Oh man, that's the best idea. I want to play like the noir game where you're a detective trying to figure out what the mayor's up to. In town that's like from a fucking Sim City, the dickhead player that's like, why is the reservoir full of shit?
It's just like Chinatown.
Yeah, it's like, forget it, Jake. It's Pooh Town. I get so. Is it tonally like Sim City? Because the thing that always gets me about, actually, so yeah, two parts of that. One is like the Sims games and Sim City have like they're really apolitical with how they present a really, really political subject, which is like, how do you create what's a good city, basically? Now, the answer for a good city is, like, it's apolitical in a way that is really political, but it doesn't really say anything with it. It's just sort of like, you know, what we want is this sort of like, you know, that power trio of things to kind of harmoniously loop together and whatever. You can't really make a city in anything other than a particular kind of American grid system and a particular American model. Mm. And because this game was made in Europe, is it possible to make a more European city in it?
No, it's not. Like, you can do things. So one of the features it has that SimCity never did is that you can paint districts on, and then you can set policies for those districts that are distinct from any other part of your town.
Huh.
And so that helps you, like, name areas and give them a distinct personality, and you can have things like, you know, this particular commercial district, I'm going to ban high-rise skyscrapers, for example, or I'm going to give them a tax break for small businesses and that kind of thing. So you can change the feel of places, and you can do little bits of stuff like making transport free or making smoke detectors free for everyone. But there's no kind of political side to it, not really. And I think they maybe dialed that stuff back, because I'm pretty sure pre-release they talked about being able to set a policy to legalize or ban gay marriage in certain areas, and that's not in the game. And there are parts of it which feel, I mean, I guess like Max's games felt, although they were very American, they were sort of a liberal America. And this feels like that much more than it does Scandinavian. And to the point where there's like interesting things like SimCity games, the taxes would always top out at 20%. You couldn't tax any more than 20%.
Yeah.
And which is, you know, true in American cities, but absurd in like Copenhagen or anywhere else in the world. And City Skylines does the same. You can't tax any more than that. And if you go up to 20%, everyone in your entire city fucking hates you for it. And it's like, this is a game made in Finland. Or something, you know, maybe Sweden.
I think it's Sweden.
Is it Sweden?
It doesn't reflect on the
Sweden, but the creative director is Finnish.
Right.
Okay. But it's aping, is it aping SimCity to such a degree that it's just not...
Like, it is. Also, it doesn't attach like tax rates to the efficiency of public services. The public services always function. That's the magic thing that happens in these...
But that's true in Scandinavia.
Because they do lose a tax and they lose money. It's that by divorcing that relationship, they've removed that big political element to it, like this big political debate as to, you know, do tax high and public services, etc.
I didn't really understand SimCity until I ended up in California. And you know, you're walking around, like, Silicon Valley or parts of the Bay Area, and you're like, obviously there are parts of San Francisco that make a fascinating city sim, because there are parts of San Francisco that are a complete shithole, which is the thing that these games never really simulate. But you go out into kind of like the tech campuses, and everything's on kind of like neat plans that someone has made, and it does look like someone's boring game of SimCity. Everything's, you know, extremely flat and very well delineated from area to area, which I guess you coming at it with a European perspective, and you're used to everything bleeding together for lack of space, is really weird. And I've kind of I think these games, they're a bit like Civilization, to take it outside the Sims thing, in that they're ultimately toys that use a real world thing as a tool to make the toy more interesting. They're not actually simulations, really, because they're, you know, like Civ is not a simulation of human history, because it's so far removed from the real considerations of human history. Like, so you go with Crusader Kings and you get closer to it, because it starts to consider all of the weird nitty gritty human stuff that goes into making history. Whereas, like, that's why I kind of want the Crusader Kings, but for city management.
Imagine a city management game where actually modeled social deprivation and had, you know, segregation between different parts of your society and the, you know, the social struggles and problems that come from that. Like, all the really difficult problems that really exist in cities, especially big cities. Like, that would be an incredible simulation to play with. But, you know, obviously, quite hard to sell. Would you like to spend... here, fix Baltimore. You're playing The Wire now.
Yeah.
I mean, just fill it with poo, isn't that?
Fill it down immediately.
SimCity always had, like, homelessness as one of the kind of groups of people you would get in your city. There was an interesting case in the last SimCity game where people on the subreddit for SimCity couldn't work out if it was a bug or a deliberate part of the simulation, but they were building these, like, functionally perfect cities that were making huge amounts of money and had, you know, basically no problems, but they couldn't get rid of the homelessness, really, which is either great political commentary.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, but then they were coming up with terrible schemes to ship the homelessness out of town or, like, find ways to wipe them out because they were just determined to have these perfect cities.
Oh, wow.
Whereas, like, City Skylines...
It's dark.
Its simulation is, I think, probably much simpler than SimCity's is. There's a whole bunch of stuff that it's not doing, but I don't find myself caring particularly, but like it has unemployed as a stat, but I haven't seen any evidence anywhere of the city of homelessness. It doesn't seem to be mentioned in the UI anywhere. You don't see homeless people walking around on the streets in the way that you would do with SimCity.
Yeah.
Do you find when playing it that you care about the simulation stuff that it's not doing? Because, like,
no.
This is what everyone was so angry about with SimCity, and partly that's the marketing of it, that they made such a big deal of their Glassbox engine, and how, you know, when people found out that people didn't live in particular houses, they just went to whatever the closest house was and slept in it. Couldn't even tell you what City Skylines does. I haven't checked. I haven't followed anyone home. Like, all the little people have names. That's kind of cool. So everyone has a name, and they get married, and you can click on the house and find, you know... little bits of personal information about them that makes them feel real, but I've never followed one to work to see if they go to the same place every day and then follow them home.
Yeah,
it could be shit in that regard, and it has made no difference to my experience.
I think that SimCity kind of like fumbled that, but I think they still put loads of processing power into doing stuff around resource units flowing down roads and stuff, which you couldn't normally see. I think they were perhaps reflected by trucks, and a lot of the problems that SimCity had was like traffic jams stalling your economy because they were actually little bits of data that were supposed to be delivered to a factory.
All of our money's in those trucks. And the trucks are stuck behind a bus.
That's literally what would happen in that simulation. And that was also, you know, seemed very CPU intensive in the way it did it, and that's maybe where a lot of the limitations of the game came from.
Yeah, I think
so I think that maybe that's where the problem was, that like they were simulating things that I agree that's a pointless thing to simulate.
Yeah, they wasted the CPU cycles simulating, because I mean, yeah, they're a toy, you know, but people still attach themselves to the simulation aspect of it, and they kind of, they want something that feels like the challenge they're being confronted with is something analogous to the challenge of designing a real city. If you're designing, you know, if you're designing a city and one of the premises of that city is all housing is free and people just sleep on the first house they go to, that so fundamentally changes what makes a city successful that it's, you know what I mean, like it's interesting as a challenge, like it's an interesting puzzle, but at that point you're wasting loads of CPU cycles simulating something that is just so unlike reality that no one really has an attachment to it. It's like an academic thing. Like, how would you design a perfect city if anyone could sleep where they wanted?
But it's the thing of, like, I don't know if City Skyline maybe works exactly the same way. I just, it hasn't come up. And the stuff that I know for sure is simplified is stuff like the sewage and the electricity. Like, SimCity, you could watch little brown poo blobs moving through your sewage system and getting sucked towards wherever you put the pump. In City Skylines, it's much more like the older SimCity games. You lay down the pipes, but then you stick a sewage pump anywhere.
It just works.
Yeah, and it just works, and it spews out brown into the water, but you can't see it moving around the world because they just fudged it.
You get poo traffic jams in SimCity.
Yeah, you really could.
And then similarly with electricity, it just moves seamlessly between buildings that are touching each other, and if you need to bridge a gap, you just put some power lines between... Essentially, like, you turn on the overlay and it just shows you the area that has electricity. And so you put a power line touching one blue blob and take it to the other blue blob, and that's it. And there's no other visual representation that it's working other than the flashing icon telling you something's broken disappears.
Yeah.
That's fine.
That's fine, yeah. I mean, I don't care about where the poo literally is at that precise moment on the ground. I don't care about that, you know. But electricity is basically magic to me anyway. It's fine for it to be magic in a game. So, yeah.
Yeah, sewage is basically magic.
Yeah.
Pretty much. lovely brown magic. I'd love to play a city building game where you design smart cities, like of the future, like based on real, like real, you know.
Well, like arcologies and things.
Yeah, so it's like.
But in that scenario, where the poo is a really important thing to consider. Like, because like, no matter how perfect and clean and beautiful your smart city is, human beings are always going to poo.
They will, but we'll have the lovely robots to take it away.
So where do the robots go? What if there's a jam in the when the poo robots leave?
The underground sewer factory.
Yeah.
Just loads of drones airlifting it out.
Into my hands.
But like a city where they're self-driving cars and like you're running like the AI of the whole thing, like the vision of the smart city is an amazing thing.
You could totally have done it in SimCity because like what makes smart cities possible is our ability to take all the information of the city that's normally invisible and make it visible by recording it by putting sensors in roads and on pedestrian crossways and stuff like that. Video games do that anyway. Yeah. It's already being simulated on my computer and it's giving me the game itself as a data readout of the things that are going on. So like SimCity already had a perfect record of where poo was going. If it actually gave you tools with which to manipulate that, that would have been a far more interesting game. And that was sort of the pitch for the expansion was Cities of Tomorrow. It was meant to be about, hey, we'll let you design smart cities. Mm-hmm. But it turned out to just be a bunch of kind of flying cars and like or drones. That was it. Everyone had drones. So it was them trying to work out, well, our traffic system's completely fucked. The simulation for this doesn't actually work. Cities of any reasonable size just create terrible traffic jams that you can't solve. Well, I know. What if everyone can fly now? Because then they don't have to use the road network and they can just move between buildings that way. Yeah. That's how they kind of... They were trying to get around the technical limitations of the game. And it didn't make for a very interesting or satisfying expansion.
That is a shame.
I want Bath... As a sim, I want any kind of city which has like a.
There's a terrible queue in the Marks and Spencers.
They ran out of hummus.
How will they get the hummus now?
They ran out of hummus in Sainsbury's today on the way.
Oh my, what a nightmare! Right. I'm surprised you're still here.
I had to buy Moroccan hummus with chickpeas.
Oh, I like Moroccan hummus. Anyway, but I'm not. I'd like a city simulator that comes at it with a historic city which is just kind of bored into the landscape in a way which can't be easily changed into. You know, appraise the problems that are inherent in a city that's been around since the Roman era, you know, and has a pretty fixed road layout. You can't really build that many new bridges over the various canals and rivers that run through Bath. And solving those problems, how you fix a city which already exists, is much more interesting than
you
to me.
You probably can't, would you?
Well, yeah, I think they can probably do a better job than the fucking council have.
You should join the council.
Yeah, I know, that's what I should do. Yeah, I'll fix it all. Take backhanders from my construction company.
Build a huge dam.
Yeah. Why is there a giant diamond cock in the centre of Bath, people will ask 20 years from now. Yes.
The Davis effect.
The memorial to the hummus wars.
Many fell.
Yeah.
I wish the exact same thing, especially like the
giant diamond cock in the centre of town.
Well, vote for
Marsh! It's the fantasy of these games is that you are the mayor of the city, and I want them to actually embrace that by having a little bit more of the political limitations. And I always feel this little pang of guilt when I place down a road and accidentally just like two skyscrapers vanish. They just get bulldozed automatically because I wanted to put a road there. Like that's not what would happen, but also...
Four-lane highway through the Jane Austen Centre.
It destroys the fantasy of that there are people that live in this city.
Because people don't ultimately care. They don't go attached to those buildings. They didn't.
Yeah, I was attached to those buildings in some way, sometimes, but the game don't care.
Yeah. You want people to. Yeah, I the reason I made a gesture then, because I had the other greatest idea of my life, which is I want SimCity, but to the level of granularity we're talking about, but for Gotham...
that's so good,
because then you can have like the elevated crime stuff and kind of like the seediness and maybe a little bit depoliticized from having to really like stare down like okay run Chicago or whatever, which is exactly what Batman comics do. They take American city problems and make them larger than life, but like imagine like making the decision as the mayor, like when you have to switch the bat signal on. Because, like, crime gets to a certain level, but you're on a cooldown and switch the bat signal on. If you zoom in really, really far, you could just see Batman on a gargoyle, like, just looking at things. Wow.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
I always feel like these simulations are just a great base for dozens of different games, and it was always, I loved SimCity 4, and I still think SimCity 4 is actually a great game, and probably still the best city management game out there, and it still looks great because it was all sprite graphics, and while it struggled in 2000 when it came out, it will run brilliantly now because it's all sprite graphics. And I just wished EA had hired like two people who had just been working on that for the last 15 years, because you get to a point in these games where you kind of, you feel, although it's still compelling to play with the systems, you've exhausted all the content of them, like your city's buildings stop changing or progressing through different architectural styles and that sort of stuff. Whereas if you just had a person who had just been working, pumping out new content for that, then that could be, you know, I want the Dwarf Fortress of City Sims, I guess. It's just like the person who, this is my project, I will still be working on this when I eventually die.
Or the, just anything better than when a building just goes brown. Which is the
it's full of poo now.
It's just the brown building that you have to press delete on, like that. Oh, fix that social problem.
Yeah,
no, it's gone brown. Let's just knock it over. It's like, they've got to do a better job of simulating when things go wrong, which they never really do at all.
The actual social ramifications of something going wrong, which is not, it's less than like, oh well, I suppose we better use our infinite demolition resource to just delete the brown that. Another building will happen. That's fine.
Mm.
Yeah.
Speaking of cities in which things have gone wrong.
Marsh. Hi.
You've been playing Mordheim.
I have.
City of the Damned.
City of the Damned, yes. The second best game set in a gothic nightmare. That was released this week. Although it's only the second best because there are only two games that were released. In fact, no, sorry, Mordheim's not been released this week, so the entire statement was pointless.
Shit.
It's been out for ages on Early Access, but it's been they've been updating it fairly regularly, and they had a couple of content patches. Came out, I think, in November of last year.
Yeah.
It's a turn-based, squad-based, tactical game based on the Warhammer IP, in which you have a bunch of different factions fighting for possession of a city, but your actual battles within it just set within kind of like some market squares and things like that, and you have maybe eight units that fight other eight, you know, another eight units for a different faction. And I never played Mordheim when it was a tabletop game. I think you did, Chris, didn't
you? Yeah, it came out in the right at the height of my teenage
I'd fallen away from the yoke of Citadel Miniatures at that point.
Yeah, you'd hit 16. The exact age when that happens. The I like the tabletop thing because it was basically Necromunda, but with dwarves.
Mm. What's interesting about the adaptation of it is that a lot of the things that I'd assume would be really useful in a tabletop game, such as a natural understanding of where all the pieces are just not available to you in Mordheim. And it seems like I don't want to prejudge it too harshly because it's still got another 6 months in early access, but it does seem they made a tactical game in which no tactics is really possible at any point. Because they've decided to go with this really locked down over the shoulder camera for whenever you select a unit. But actually that gives you very limited view as to what the battlefield looks like, where any other units are, what they are, in, you know, where they are in relation to you. Particularly this is problematic because a lot of the levels are procedural or, you know, not entirely the same each time. So there's no way you could just learn a map and then you'll just drop back into it and know it. But there are some maps that are the same each time. But on top of that, there's just a lot of data that just, I mean, also you can pull out like this tactical overview. But it's so far out, you can't see your units anymore. You can see them represented by icons, but unless you're familiar with the icons, you don't know what that unit is, if you're playing it for the first time. You can't really tell where they are, because it's so far out. Like, you can't tell whether they're in a building or not. If they are in a building, you can't see through the roofs of buildings. So, for example, there's one level that takes place entirely inside a cathedral. To a point, to the tactical map, you're just looking at a roof. The entire thing's in the roof. It's like all the geography of all kind of pews and all the fallen rafters and things like that that make up the kind of game space at that level. It's just not observable. It's completely useless. You can't tell what elevation they're at in relation to each other. And so you kind of...
It's more realistic though, Marsh.
Well, no, it isn't, because
if you were a predator drone in the Warhammer universe, you only see that roof. Unless you had a thermal imaging camera.
But your role is as an omniscient controller of all these units. So you can kind of, you eventually piece it together, but when you've gone through the turn order. The other thing is you can't tell which of your units is which from the turn order. Like, you can see their icons in the turn order, but some of them are the same icon because they're the same unit type. You can't tell which one's which. You can't tell which one has different health. So the entire point of having a turn order, or not the entire point, but one of the value of having a turn order in a tactical game, is that you can see when a unit's going to activate, and you're going to like, well, he's going to be a problem for me. He doesn't activate for 5 turns yet. We'll fuck him up in those 5 turns and prevent him from ever attacking. You can't really do that in this, because you don't know where the fuck they are in the turn order. You can't tell where they go. When they move, the camera switches to an enemy's... When the enemy activates, the camera switches to this cinematic view, which is often behind scenery, and it just kind of cuts in really close to them and tracks them as they move from a number of different angles. Prevents you from understanding which unit was the one that was activated or where it's going. It's really strange. And, like, I understand that, you know, 6 months are left. Obviously, development is hard. And you try things during development that sometimes don't work and stuff like that. But, like, they haven't realised that the stuff that they are preventing is the game that they're trying to make. Like, without that stuff, you can't do any of the things that game requires of you. So it's a bit disappointing in that respect. Yeah. Otherwise, it's all right, I suppose.
He's already dead, Marsh.
This is a shame. I love more time as the original design. I think it's one of the best things. Okay, Games Workshop, which I love, their universes, I think they've made some pretty bad games, actually, like systems-wise. Mm. I think Mordheim is one of their best.
Right, because I was talking to Chris about this, because my theory is that a lot of Warhammer games were good because of the preparation that you put into them and the kind of soul that you put into them, into the painted them, into you crafted these armies, and you got together and you had a kind of social experience.
Yeah.
And really the games were or could have been total shat and you wouldn't really notice.
Mm.
I think a lot of them were crap. In that, yeah, there was an awful lot of people flipping through pages going, I think you'll find that the D6 roll.
They were so overcomplicated. Like, in hindsight, they were let's not get into it.
But Mordheim was good, was it?
Mordheim was really, really good. Like, it's really tight. It was, because you weren't rolling, 20 dice per unit in an army of 100 figures. It was just about, 7 to 12 guys, and, they had unique personalities, these brilliant wounding mechanics that would give them, they'd lose an arm, but you'd replace it with something else, or a leg, and you'd replace it with a peg leg. That would alter their stats and things like that. That would affect your rolls. You're already rolling, a few dice per combat. It was just very, very quick. And you got to build some amazing scenery and, exploit it in very
interesting ways. Yeah, it was all about, vertical scenery and, people falling off planks and...
I can say all of that stuff is kind of in it, actually. Mm. There will be, persistence, and you will have a squad which you cultivate over a number of turns in a campaign. That's not in it yet. But it's interesting how what you're saying about combat being really quick translates in an underwhelming way to this experience, because instead of it being just pacey, it feels just like you're tactically underpowered, basically. Mm. You can only really do one thing in a turn. It's really what you've got to do. The most exciting point of that game is the first round where you do your positioning of units. In the games I played, I've often been clustered in the center of a space, which I presumably kind of just basically have to defend. So the thing I do is I arrange my units around all what I can see are being the choke points, although because of the fucking tactical map and the fact I can't see anything properly means that I usually make bad decisions. But once that's done, then you engage in combat, and you're just standing around those units for the rest of the game, going through your turn order, saying, "Yep, I'll probably attack again actually this turn, I think."
Mm.
And then attritionally, you either win or lose.
Yeah, most people in Mordheim are pathetic. They're underpowered kind of scoundrels. There are a couple of characters on Chaos Possessed and things like that which have multiple wounds. Most of them just have one, and if you get through someone's armor, which almost no one has armor because it's really expensive, then it's quite.
Oh, they have hit points in this, so they do have the wounding system is only part of its persistence. Like, if you get knocked out during combat, then you have a chance to die or get a wound in the next game.
Right.
So in Mordheim, the original, you had some
There were knockdown things. It was about melee, basically. It was like the whole rule set was meant to make combat between mooks much faster. So if you're 2-on-1, one guy gets a knockdown, then the other one basically automatically kills him.
Oh, okay. Wow, okay.
Is that's the kind of brutality they were going for with it. And it might not be, it might translate once you finish the round and, you know, you come out of the game, you roll to see what they're actually wounded. Like, he might still be alive, you know. He was just taken out of action.
Right.
And then the wounding mechanics come in sometimes. And it's quite hard. They sometimes just completely die, and obviously you've lost them. But the point is that at the point of contact, like, if it's a rat ogre and a guy, and just like a guy with a pitchfork.
Oh, yeah.
Only one outcome there.
Yeah, the rat ogre does just pound things.
Yeah, that's what happens. But they're really expensive. Like, there's always, you know, risk reward for that. Yeah, the thing about more time enabled as a rule set was amazingly acrobatic turns, where, especially if you're playing a Skaven, for example, one of their best things are, like, claws, hand, like, they already have claws, but they put bigger claws on their claws because they're Skaven. But the claws aren't only devastating in close combat, they climb really quickly. So in one turn as a Skaven with these claws, you could climb up one wall, run across a rooftop, then do a diving charge on a guy somewhere else. And like, there's loads of failure built into that. If you fail your, you know, climbing roll, then you could just fall over, break your back, and, you know, you have to spend a time getting up. Mm. But it's the kind of, the scope for doing that kind of stuff was there. That was really exciting, and doesn't sound like that's really translated.
You can clamber over the scenery, and there is a lot of verticality to it, but the problem is none of it's really easily perceived from the player's perspective, okay. There's an even greater risk in even dallying with that stuff, because you might climb up somewhere, run across a beam, and then realise actually the kind of low wall that you're running into is impassable, and there's only one place you can really jump down from there, and it actually jumps you down into somewhere you've already been, or, you know, I don't know.
I suppose the thing the miniatures game couldn't have, the problem it couldn't have is that, because you would assemble the city from parts and it would have everyone who has a really clear sense of where everything is, because they are physically...
Giant there. Men compared to these tiny figures.
Yeah.
I tell you, there is something interesting and weird about the game. I was wondering if you could think of other examples. But the movement system in the game, there's no grid. It's completely free movement. So when you have an active character, you can just move him anywhere you like. But with... as you pass, like, these concentric circumferences. So as you pass one circumference, then you've lost, a movement point, what is called a strategy point here. Then you can see where the next one is, and you can move that. But what this means, you can actually backtrack through the places where you broached each circumference and regain your strategy points if you want to just say, I don't want to move it there anyway. But what this allows you to do is to walk way away from your character's initial position, completely scout an area, see loads of enemies who are otherwise invisible to you, say, I know where they are now, and just walk back to where you were originally, and then do something completely different. So, which is kind of, I find, like, actually, as a game mechanic, that works, that's fine. Assuming everybody has the same capability, that's okay.
I mean, that's more like a miniatures game where you can see where the other guy's miniatures are anyway.
Yeah, but it's interesting that in its abstraction of combat, he has created something which is actually impossible in combat.
Yeah. This is a game about time travellers.
Yeah. Yes. Psychic mice, in my case. I don't know. Are there other examples of that where a game has kind of tried to abstract something and then created something which is unique and gamey, but kind of okay, even though it breaks the entire point of what it's trying to simulate?
SimCity.
Yeah.
Playing... The Bureau, the XCOM game, which is a kind of horrible mishmash of, like, it has enormously troubled development and, you know, like, it screams at you as you try and play it. But it's got this kind of tactics mode where you're in control of a squad, and it's kind of a third person Gears of War style shooter with squad elements, which work a bit like the Brothers in Arms games, and I used to play it. Very good. World War II shooters. But the way you order your squad mates about is you press B on the controller to enter tactics mode. And then you become a cursor, and you walk around the game as the cursor, which
you
moves
walk
it,
as a cursor.
Yeah, the reason I say that is because you move at the same speed as if you were a character in the game, and you are, you know, impeded in the same way that characters would be if your cursor, this abstract icon, was actually a human being.
Right.
So, like, you have to walk it upstairs to get to places. It's the strangest. Like, the most poorly implemented kind of, like, idea that, like, it's like, why would you tie me to the physical world when I'm a floating fucking, you know, pointer on the map? But yeah, here I am, so walking along at this plodding pace of, you know, an agent. I want to go up to that balcony, and I've got, in XCOM, it's a cursor, so you just, like, move over there and it clips up to where the balcony is. Now I've got to go left, walk up some stairs, then walk around this cabinet, and then walk this cursor to this place, and then I can call in an airstrike, even though a laser airstrike, even though I'm in the 30s or something, and also I'm like a mile deep in an underground bunker. And then you activate that, and then an airstrike comes through the ceiling, and these lasers kill these guys. I was like, whoa, this game is so much more fucked than I even thought it would be. Just conceptually, almost everything you do has some logical flaw. Like, there's logic flaws everywhere in the way you move around and the way everything works.
I sort of feel that way about, I mean, to be honest, any game, any game where you control a party of characters and you can give them all individual moves, abstracts what giving orders is actually like. Like, if you want a real simulation of what giving orders is like, play Mountain Blade multiplayer, Napoleonic Wars, and listen to people fucking yelling at each other to, just stand in a line, everybody turn. Because, and I think that's the thing that I'd love to see a game actually, this is not like the thing that one game abstracts that changes what the game is about completely. It's something that every game extracts to the point that there really aren't, I can't really think of a strategy game.
There are some really great tactical war games that do it. No, I can't remember any of their names right now. But the kind of things like Tim Stone would play.
Yeah, I was going to say, Tim Stone would put these in the features.
Stuff where you're a general, but you're sending your orders to the front lines, and sometimes those orders just get lost, because you're writing them on a bit of notepaper and handing them to a man, and sometimes he gets killed or distracted.
Just had another idea. Imagine an RPG, a party-based RPG, where...
Batman.
No, you pause to give orders, like in Pillars of Eternity or anything else. You have one character, who's your main character. And you pause and you give orders. If you've given the order to your main character, they'll just do it, because it's you just deciding to do it. Every other order you do is then spoken by the main character. So, like, get in there, do this, do that, blah, blah, blah. And the likelihood of the AI character doing it is based on how they like you. So if a character doesn't like you, they just carry on with their AI routine and do what they would do anyway.
Yeah, Deadnoughts does that.
Does it?
And,
I think there are other games as well,
aren't there? There's a few games like that. If their relationship with their fellows is bad, they'll just do their own thing.
That's like the idea of actually manifesting the ordering process inside the game, so you actually see them go pointing and going, like, get over behind that wall, or get back, you're really wounded, or whatever. Like, that'd be rad.
No, I refuse to get behind this wall because I'm wounded, because I hate you!
Yeah, but you can have other considerations as well, bravery and whatever. Like, you tell, get in there and save him, and they don't like each other, and it's like, no. Just like, drama. That'd be cool. Anyway, that doesn't exist, so moot, really.
Yeah, anyway, bit of disappointing. Are there any words that you'd like to say with your mouth about games, Chris?
Well, I have been also playing loads of Off-World Trading Company, which is Soren Johnson's new game, so kind of looping into the management strategy things. Very interesting. RTS about, RTS without combat, really, about manipulating stock markets and resources and things. And it's dead good, and I played loads of it, but I'm still learning it, and I think I'm going to talk about it next week, because, one, we talked about loads of Pillars of Eternity, and two, I'd like to talk about it from a position of not just gaining an understanding of it, but actually maybe seeing underneath the hood a bit.
Some more of us will probably play it by next week as well.
Yeah, also, I'd really like to play against someone other than the AI, because the AI is very good, but I imagine it'd be really interesting against fallible, awful humans. So maybe that'll be a next week thing. Shall we do Questiones from Questiones?
Si.
Yes, please.
I don't know what language that was.
It's not a language, I'm just mispronouncing a word. Good. But which questions? It's a question I should have answered to myself before suggesting that. John writes, hi all.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Hello.
Yo.
That was me being John. No, but it wasn't in the email. What the email says is, hi all.
Capital A, all.
Yeah, hi all. As if God-like. Addressing a deity.
I hope we give every word of this the same level of
scrutiny.
Yeah,
it'll be a long letter section, Marty. Was listening to the definitely not disappointing episode 81 this morning. Faint praise. Thanks, John. As my headphones have been broken for some time and I'm playing catch up, when a question occurred to me, mostly for Chris. I understand that Chris has come to PC gaming from a console background, and I am going to correct this in a second, but I'll get through the rest of the email. And please don't tune out for fear that this will be a Master Race question, as you pretty comprehensively knocked that one on the head. My question is, do you think that having a background in consoles influences your taste in games? For example, I get the distinct impression that you're a Dota fan, which apparently features a competitive element. My memories of console games when I was growing up was that a lot of them also featured a competitive element, in the sense that that was the only time I ever played console games with others. PC gaming has always been, for me, a fairly solitary pursuit. Do you think the two are correlated in any way, or am I doing tragic disservice to the rich spread of console gaming and totally ignoring the deeply competitive streak embedded in PC gaming? Feel free not to read out the bit about ludonarrative dissonance. Ah, I see what he's done there. Keep up the great work, everybody. Yours, John.
Look.
So, I think he's, a couple of weeks ago, I want to kind of correct this first, but I think there's a broader point in there. I don't have a background in console gaming. I just play a lot of console games from the years 2006 to 2009.
How dare you?
I grew up playing PC games, and I guess I had Mega Drive when I was a kid. But then, when I was at university, I didn't upgrade my PC at all. So it got too old to play games on, and I bought an Xbox to play games on that for a couple of years. So there's a slice of time where my experience of games like Bioshock comes entirely from console experiences. It's really no more interesting than that. So I can't really talk to having a console background, really. It was more of a phase. An ongoing phase in some ways, because, yeah.
Dabbled with it at university, but, you know.
But the notion that, the PC gamers are a solitary pursuit. I think this is one of the things that, I mean, the reason I was going to bring that up is because it, for me, it kind of compounds, like, one of the reasons that making any kind of, like, qualitative or, you know, meaningful distinction between where you play your games is that it really depends from what angle you come at it from. That actually console gaming means something different to everybody who owns a console, depending what games they like, and PC gaming means something completely different based on what games you like. If you only played Dota, and I know a lot of Dota pros who only ever really played Dota, they never played another game, the notion of playing an RPG or a simulator or a strategy game of like a sitcom or anything that we'd normally really associate with the PC is completely alien to them. For them, PC gaming is competitive online wizard clicking. And that's what the PC is. I don't know if anyone else has any input on that. I just think you can't really define it.
I think there's an interesting kind of back and forth between console and PC when it comes to competitive stuff. Because obviously the PC was, well, it existed before console, so it did have a bit of a head start there. But also the online stuff, it was quite hard to get into, I think. Like private servers and things like that probably had like a... just a barrier to entry, which wasn't there for consoles. So I think for a lot of people, when they came to consoles, it was probably a social experience that took them there or appealed to them in a big way. And obviously, social experiences in games are often competitive, but with things like matchmaking and dedicated servers and things, not dedicated, like central servers, it took a lot of the pain out of playing online. So I think there are probably quite a lot of people who do identify consoles with a certain kind of competitive online multiplayer, perhaps erroneously in terms of like characterizing what those platforms could be used for potentially or what they're capable of. But I kind of get the sense that people who play on consoles are probably a large portion of them are more multiplayer friendly. I don't know.
It's interesting. I'd like
to know the stats.
Yeah, I mean. I suppose a lot of people will come to consoles because a console is something that was bought for the living room to be used by multiple people. And, you know, it's kind of a social thing in that regard, whereas a PC is something that sits in the corner of a study. And your time with it is solitary by nature of the machine. And therefore, when you move on to, say, I know when I was a teenager playing Team Fortress Classic or something, that's still sort of solitary. And, you know, we're from a generation that when we were growing up, things you were doing on the internet were solitary, even if you were doing them with other people. You know, my parents and sister would definitely consider the time I spent playing MMOs to be time I was spending alone.
Yes, yeah.
Even though, technically, that's you, Graham.
Thank you.
And so there is, there are many different interpretations of what multiplayer really means in that context. Like, I necessarily put that in the same sort of, like, genre of experience as playing Mario Kart on the SNES.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's the difference between local multiplayer and online multiplayer.
Mm.
I think the difference isn't so much in the machines. It's, as you say, it's the place in your house it inhabits. Like, your console plugged into your TV probably has a couch in front of it. My PC has only ever had a single chair in front of it. That alone is enough to inhibit my ability to play it with other people. And although I do agree with what you were saying, Marsh, and I'd be interested to know, like you say, the stats, like how many people were introduced to online FPS through Halo versus through Unreal Tournament.
Yeah. But I think the other interesting thing is that the gamepads that ship with the Xbox, even possibly the Xbox One, came with like a headset. At a time when talking to people you were playing with online wasn't a big thing on PC, certainly.
I think that probably sold Xbox Live, which had a subscription fee. It was, you know, you can talk to the monsters.
Well, I see it as like this thing that's that kind of, you know, the culture of what we now think of as multiplayer is something that's been kind of passed off between consoles and PC and back and forth.
Mm.
And now it's just, I think it's quite, the kind of experience you can expect to get from an online game is, it's obviously diverse, but it's also homogenous in terms of, like, you're not going to go to a console and get a substantially different online experience now, I think, than from PC, with the exception of, I don't know, it's really, you know, like hardcore obscure game. Yeah.
I mean, I think an interesting thing, like, so when I'm defending the time I spent on Destiny to people, which I find myself doing quite a lot, the thing I say is it's the most fun I've had with MMO since Vanilla WoW, really. Mm. And that's not just a meaningless comparison. It's actually because, and I think it's because WoW, when it came out on PC, was quite a novel experience in a lot of ways. Obviously, it built on what EverQuest had done before it, and Asheron's Call, and a few other MMOs. But it had never been that polished before or that kind of complete. And notions of, like, instances, you know, people forget that WoW invented the notion that you go into a dungeon with a limited number of people and you complete a set challenge. That was pretty revelatory at the time, and it defined how MMO combat and content not only worked, but was conceived in terms of time by the people who played it. Mm-hmm. Like, the idea of running a dungeon didn't really exist in the same way before WoW codified it. And so that the experience, when I talk about the experience of Vanilla WoW, is of discovering those things when it was still sort of like, it wasn't a formula that everybody instinctively understood. Now, when someone's advertising a new MMO, if they ever do again, they talk about, oh, we're going to have this many instances on launch. You know, you've got to imagine it being in the time when someone goes, what's an instance? Hmm. Rather than just, oh, so we should expect this a number of half-hour experiences. And the reason Destiny is a bit like that is because it has a lot of WoW's ideas, it has instances in the same way, but it's brought them to an audience that traditionally isn't necessarily used to them, and it's brought it to a genre that's traditionally never really done it well. And obviously not everyone who... it's not. So even if the ideas are familiar to you, it's in a context, a console shooter that has changed it. And that means that it's recreated that sense of entering in something that someone else hasn't really done. That's at the highest level of Destiny, where you're running like really hard raids and stuff. And the community's really nice, and I think there's a direct correlative between the two. It doesn't have the rot that sets in when a genre has been stagnant for a long time and the community has rarefied in its taste for one very specific experience to the extent that it becomes really exclusionary to other people coming in from the outside and not understanding it, which is true of a lot of PC genres, I would argue. Whereas on, so that's in a way, like, yes, it's an analogous experience, and it's like what you say, multiplayer becoming more homogenous, a traditionally very PC experience happening on console. But the fact that there's a divide at all has freshened it in a way, so it does show that even if things are doing the same stuff, they still operate on different cycles and different communities treat things differently. So I'd say it still is different. I don't know what my point is there.
It's good though. It's nice to hear you just talk, really.
Thanks.
Beautiful voice.
I like local multiplayer, and I'm really glad that there are more and more games appearing on PC that are all about local multiplayer. And this idea that the PC could become a living room device, that social device, with the Steam boxes and things like that, other conceptions of that, would mean more games like Nidhogg, games like Gang Beasts, fucking fantastic games on PC that would make just incredible TV couch games. And I wish that aspect of the console experience would translate onto my platform.
Tom Sabatino writes, gentlemen, he puts a space in it, suggesting that we are soft and gentlemen. Tom F's story about the scary big whale last week reminded me why I stopped playing Elite Dangerous. Every time I'd jump out of Super Cruise right in front of a huge friggin' star, my heart would sink and I'd get that tingly feeling in my testicles. And I'd have to walk away and go pat the cat for a bit. It caused a fear that wasn't the same as a zombie jumping out of a cupboard or something hang on, jumping out of a cupboard or seeing some undead freak with a nail in its face. It was something primordial and animal, realizing your insignificance next to something indescribably large. Any games give you guys and possible gals similar feelings? If so, how did you overcome them? I'd love to play Elite Dangerous some more. Sad face. Cheers.
I did have a very similar experience. I mean, like, I was kind of surprised that Tom was specifically scared of whales when he mentioned it last week. But I understand being afraid of the water and being afraid of very large things in the water that might eat you. And certainly I was playing Subnautica like a number of months ago, like, which is a game about exploring an alien ocean, basically. It totally triggers like primordial fear in me. Like there's a moment where, you know, I was scooting along the ocean bed, and just this huge shadow began to pass across the sand in front of me and engulfed me. And like, I think I was talking to you, Chris, about exactly the reaction I had, and you pointed out that I think like back in the olden days of evolution, like the first kind of eyes that creatures developed were just sensors on their back, so they could detect things, you know, passing in front of the light, which is the sun, because then that would be the predators generally swooping down upon them. And seeing a shadow, even now, where I don't even have eyes on my back anymore, but seeing a giant shadow engulf you is underwater is fucking terrifying. Mm. And it was a real struggle to play that game and overcome my just natural fear of the deep, I think. But I did. It was great. It's really good. It might still be good, actually. Maybe I should go back and play it more.
Mm. I may have told the story on the podcast before, but there's one I love. And like, because I really get this feeling as well. And I get it in Elite, but I covet that feeling a lot. Like, I mean, it's, you know, it's the concept of sublimity, right? Like where you kind of encounter something kind of indescribably large. As the opposite of, you know, he talks about horror. It's a horror point in a way. The horror he's talking about, like zombies and scary things with monsters, is all about detail and little things and like gross specificity that weirds you out because your mind correlates it directly with something weird, whereas this is all about things that's like, fuck, that's huge, and that animal kind of gut reaction, which I love. And you get it in Elite as well when capital ships exit hyperspace, because it presents it brilliantly. It does this kind of, you know, capital class signature detected thing, and then, you know, a huge storm appears and this sort of vast, you know, initially almost like a shadow, like a silhouette, kind of just like starts to kind of form, and then this vast spaceship arrives and you're like, wow, every time. The example that I really like to give for this is Freelancer, which was a very, very, very good open world space adventure game. Not quite a sim, controlled in the third person, but you could still fly around, trade and dock at stations and do combat and stuff like that. And the backstory of Freelancer was that a new area of the galaxy had been settled by evacuees from our solar system, basically, who'd left in these vast colony ships. And there were five of them, and they all represented different Earth nations. And one of them vanished, and it was the Hispanic one, which is called the Hispania. And you sort of... And it's a great bit of environmental storytelling as well as a thing. You complete the entire story, and there's four nations, because those are the four surviving colony ships, you know, approximately like European and American, and I think it's a Chinese one. But as you play through the game, you notice that quite a lot of the pirates who like live on asteroids and kind of eke out a living and seem to come from nowhere in particular have Hispanic names. And like their space stations are named after cities in Spanish speaking countries and stuff like that. And it's not a part of the main plot at all, but if you follow that thread enough and become trusted with them enough, you can find a wormhole in a distant area of space and find out where they're coming from, which is a system with a planet in it. It's the only pirate planet in the game, which is Malta. And that's where the pirate system is. And he's like, oh, I think we've found what happened to the survivors of that vanished colony ship. But if you fly off into the distance in that system, and it's very crude now. If you look for a screenshot, it's nowhere near as impressive. But I remember doing this and like someone telling me, like, go out in this direction. And you'll kind of be flying through a kind of like a space cloud. It really heavily uses space clouds to avoid everything, like actually looking at space, and an asteroid belt. And there's a sort of fuzzy signal in the distance, and you arrive, and it's just this vast, derelict, because you can't see the other colony ships, because the point is by then they've long been broken down and turned into cities on planets and stuff. But it's just this vast kind of like not wounded, but kind of like stricken spaceship, sort of like hanging in the stars with like a few ships still orbiting it, picking it clean. And it's that kind of like amazing encounter with like history and scale, and it's spooky. It's weird. Like finding it was almost scary in a way, because it feels like you're kind of
Cool.
Not supposed to see it. I don't know. Really, really cool bit of environmental storytelling. Very cheap to do as well, I imagine, if you just put a huge fucking grey rectangle in space. Terrifying. Sean Purdy writes, "Good day, gentle people. Thanks for the wonderful podcast. You fill my daily commutes with humour and profound ponderances." Be nice.
He called us gentle again.
No, no, he's very nice. I just think he's probably overestimating our profundity, that's all.
"Perhaps this has been brought up before, but I find it odd that so many games that rely upon a progression of gear to improve your character seem to so constantly force your character to look like they were dressed by a 3 to 5 year old. I quite often find myself torn between aesthetics that and increases to my character's stats. Games like Diablo 3 deal with this situation by allowing you to enchant your weapons and armor to look like others that you have found already, and Star Wars Knights of the Republic provides a method of basically slotting in different items that provide the majority of the stats into a primarily aesthetic outfit." Excuse me while I shuffle. "So my question is, what is the most outrageous looking thing you've ever worn on one of your characters to boost your stats, but winced at every time you saw it, or vice versa, have you ever given up large amounts of stats simply to maintain a particular aesthetic for your character? And what is the best way you can think of or seen that this has been handled, aside from hide helmet? If you're willing to humour me for another quick question slightly related, then what is the best way you've ever seen in accessories and inventory handled in a game? In Skyrim and in other similar games, I find myself constantly carrying around very specific sets of armour and accessories, such as having a different ring, necklace and set of boots for defence against every type of magic in the game. Though this is kind of interesting at first, in the end you just end up with a full backpack and constant battle of interruptions where you re-accessorize while enemies politely wait frozen. I can understand this in a game that has specific enemy types for different regions, but often in Skyrim you run into different sets of enemies that constantly have random abilities, so you can't have known beforehand what resistances you needed. I like the concept of it, but would probably rather see it as more of an active switching between different defense modes in response to being attacked, rather than having to constantly adjust my outfit. What are your thoughts about this mechanic and system? How would you handle it or not? Keep up the excellent work, Sean."
I have no opinions about the second one, but we've certainly had some pretty fucking natty clothing yes. choices in our Dark Souls playthrough, haven't we?
It's great. We've got a
dildo squid hat.
The most beautiful hat. It does indeed look like a squid.
Or a dildo.
Or a dildo, depending on the angle, the way the light strikes it. Mm. And we've just got a big sword, with big kind of punchy melee class.
Nice dress for a while.
Yeah, we had a lovely, lovely priestess. It was like it specified in the description that it was for a lady. But we wore it anyway.
Bill Thurston wore it.
the dildo hat was for, it's like a mage item. And we're like a melee item. And frankly, given my skill, we could do with the fucking stats. Like, we could do with that. We could do with the defense. We could do with, like, a big kind of male helm.
And did we? I think we might have swapped it out for another helmet in an as yet unpublished video. But
I hope it was even more ridiculous, because I can't remember now.
It's the Onion Knights.
Oh, Onion Knight helmet. It was more ridiculous. Fantastic. It
looks like a giant onion.
Because part of your character, choosing to kind of go against the rule set kind of makes you quirky. It's like a man wearing a fedora. In real life, in the streets, and that it becomes like people don't normally do that because it's something they want that to be their identity. But in a game, I'll take that. If it's all I've got available to me, I'll take dildo hat. That will be who I am,
as opposed to a fedora, which is just a hat for a dildo.
Yeah. When are the rest of those videos going up, Tom?
Episode 37 is going up when I get home. So one of our episodes broke, or I broke it, I think. But we've struggled past that. IRL, we've completed the game, and we've got the rest of our playthrough ready to go up, and then we're already into the DLC. It's very exciting, and those will be resuming on our YouTube channel. YouTube.com/GreatCrowbar.
I always put aesthetics before stats to such a degree that I can't think of a time when I've really genuinely worn something stupid because I needed the stats. At all, really. To the point that, like, in Dragon Age Inquisition, I would make multiple sets with different armor properties to make sure how it looked before I would settle on which one I wanted to go with. That's because I'm an idiot. So, regards to the second half of the question, I think we've actually talked about this in some detail in a recent podcast. We had, like, two in a row where we talked about the physicality of inventory management. Actually, Skyrim is an example of, like, again, like, you know, with, like ordering commands instantly and psychically to your teammates, being able to pause time to put different pants on is a power that's taken completely for granted in RPGs, but you could build an interesting game mechanic around just needing to get changed. Mm. Like, my thing is, this is another, every time I talk about RPGs, I sound like a fucking madman.
But the thing I like to do in RPGs is I don't like to wear armor that I've found in a dungeon unless it's feasible that that armor would fit anyone. Because really, armor is quite often custom made. You know, if you wear armor that's just for anybody, that's why peasants die in war, because they get given like a breastplate that's been worn by like 5 previous dead people. It doesn't fit. Like, you wouldn't just wear something you found in the dungeon. You'd have it at least reforged by a smith.
You're right. You do sound mental.
So I normally will, like, the armor my characters equip will be armor that's been bought with money raised by selling stuff. That makes sense to me. Hmm. But the idea of just wearing something you found in a cave, that makes sense. You wouldn't just, if you found a pair of pants in the street, you wouldn't be like, oh, free pants.
Speak for yourself.
No, because you try to put them on, you're like, oh, well, these pants were for a man that's much smaller than me or larger than me.
I'd take these pants to our mighty blacksmith.
Yeah. So that you could take those pants to a tailor and go, Taylor,
eBay. Yeah.
Reforge these pants. And while you're at it, why not bring it in line with my character's personal brand?
Add a rune or two. Go on, add a nice fire rune.
Exactly. All of this makes complete sense. It plays the verisimilitude of the world. I don't see why it's a problem, and I don't see why I'm still talking about it.
I seem to talk about it a lot as well, but Neo Scavenger is still my favourite for inventories, and in that is the game in which you will find pants on the street and you will put them on for their stats benefit because you're cold.
But do they fit?
I think sometimes the shoes don't fit. I think you can get shoes that are ill-fitting shoes that actually hurt your feet.
Exactly. You're not a Neo well accounted for. You're a Neo scavenger.
Beggars can be choosers.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so you do end up wearing this weird mishmash of, like, ripped trousers, one shoe that you stole from a hobo you found dead, a t-shirt with a cartoon character on it on top of a hospital gown that you haven't taken off yet because every little bit of heat helps. And like a baseball cap that you found. It's great.
Scoo writes, and this is a question that I chose purely because it's kind of continuing the thread of me sounding insane about RPGs again, but hey, might be able to help. Do any of you have any advice for how I can think of a name for my Pillars of Eternity characters? Normally takes me ages.
Well, you clearly have an answer.
I do, but I want to make sure. Okay, so... So this is how I do it, because I don't like using the same characters in multiple games, same character names in multiple games, because it can make it feel less specific, makes it feel less like a narrative that's happening to that character if you just keep calling people the same thing. And I just couldn't bring myself to like call every character like Dr. Pants or whatever people do. So the methodology I've settled on is once I figure out who the character is in terms of like, you know, class and race and all the rest of that, is I find a word that'd be meaningfully associated with that thing, translate it into Old English, translate it into Latin, translate it into a bunch of other things until you find a cool sounding couple of syllables, and then sometimes that's enough, and then other times just tweak it a little bit. Like did this with my Dark Souls character, which is like, I did Old English at uni, so I like some of the double meanings in Old English, which are like words that have split into multiple different, you know, etymological branches, since it can create kind of cool little puns. So my Dark Souls character is called Telen, which is the Old English verb for both to count and to be accounted, which kind of just like, I thought it was kind of a cute little thing on the acquisitive nature of that game. But that's where you get the, you get teller, as in, bank teller from that thing. Basically just be a big twat. Brookapod writes, here's another vote for hearing or seeing Bloodborne, especially if we can get Rich Stanton.
Yep, I think we can wing that, yes.
Yeah. Other than this, your most wanted console game on PC?
Red Dead Redemption.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
That'd be good. That'd be nice.
I don't know why they haven't released Halo on PC. Well, not, you know, the recent Halos.
Yeah, the ones that doesn't work.
Hmm.
I was going to say Mario Kart. I'd like Mario Kart as a service, like a drop-in, drop-out service on PC. I want to be able to call someone like Skype, but instead of going into a Skype call, it just loads you both into a Mario Kart circuit with voice. So you can just hang out with people, but rather than having to just like stare at a still image of their face like in Skype, you can at least play Mario Kart.
You can play Mario Cars, right? That's
that's
a probably a better experience. I suggest everybody checks out Mario Cars, downloads it. It's such a cracking game.
Can't think of anything on PC like Mario Galaxy. Don't think there's anything else like that on PC.
Mario Galaxy was going to be my suggestion as well.
I was playing, briefly, I played Oceanhorn this week as well, which is a Zelda, basically, but on PC. It is an Zelda.
one Zelda.
Yeah. It's just so Zelda.
That's a Zelda.
You have a sword, you have a shield, your dad's gone missing. Yeah, it's weird actually. The strange thing about it is it spends so long doing its kind of introductory narrative, whereas the thing that is charming about all Zelda games is that their narrative is little more than a motif.
Mm.
And the way that it plays with that motif is quite fun and interesting. But it's the point of it is that it is minimal, because then it decreases the time between you and actually playing this game. Whereas this has loads of cutscenes and, you know, voiceovers. And
never underestimate the hunger for lore, Marsh. People want a bit of grit. They want something they could write fan fiction about.
I've been playing Darksiders 2, which is also and Zelda.
Mm. Oh yeah, that's a good Zelda though.
I like it so much, and I don't really know. I like it far more.
It doesn't deserve the love that I have for that game. I really did like Dark Souls 2.
There's something about it. I like its art for some reason.
We have a running joke in the office about Tom's love for like 3-year-old 6 out of 10 action adventure games. Darksiders actually is.
Yeah, it's probably a 7 out of 10 action game.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, like, it wasn't that long ago that I walked in the office and you were playing Viking Battle for Asgard. And you reliably the only person in the world playing these games.
I really wanted that to be good.
It's not good. It's not good. I could confirm.
Yeah, the other day you were playing Darksiders 2 in the office, and I think 3 of us independently laughed out loud.
For some reason, every lunchtime I boot up a different 6 or 7 out of 10, and I never know which it's going to be. Will it be a 6? I think my next one's going to be Singularity, for example.
That's an
8.
Is it?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I'll find out. 6.5.
No, that's an 8. That's the golden age of shooters that
really
nothing. 8. It's the golden age of like just 8 out of 10 shooters with really good guns, like Metro from the same era.
Good guns. It restricted you from using them in any particularly interesting situations, though. The whole time shifting mechanic. They never went through with
that. Maybe it is a 7.
Let's compromise. We'll go with a 7 just to get consensus.
Okay. If I have a strange
journalism,
if I have a strange unexplained urge to play it, it's probably a 7.
Yeah,
this is what I've come to realise about this.
I tell you what, you should play instead. Although Singularity is interesting to play in that there's going to be a sequel, and so you should probably see it. But Raven are an interesting studio. Raven makes Singularity, and they also made the Wolverine game, which is actually really weirdly quite good.
What?
Yeah, I know. I think it was part and parcel of the Wolverine Origins launch, but bears no relation whatsoever to the film as far as you can see. But as with all Raven games, like, they're really good at the kind of second-to-second combat, and they usually put that in level design, which is arbitrary and awful, and then the entire kind of meta structure of the game is trash as well. But Wolverine has really just a really rewarding slashy combat system, and you can see that they've recycled load of art assets from abandoned projects, which is also the case with Singularity as well.
Right,
like, clearly that was
8 out of 10.
That was stuff that was left over from their terrible Wolfenstein game.
Okay,
and they just like, we could put this in Wolfenstein. We could just save this back and launch our own IP. And that's probably libelous.
He said, not legally.
Yeah. I'm sure they didn't do that. I'm sure that whatever they did was completely above board and within the limits of their contracts that they'd signed.
Keep on digging. And should we stop asking questions to ourselves? What?
Yes, let's stop getting in legal trouble.
I like playing weird, broken old games because I like seeing what's gone wrong and trying to identify very specifically what's gone wrong with it and why it's particularly failed in a given instance. Often the times it's just because it's like Battle for Asgard is just so dated it's impossible to really compare it to, you know, modern stuff. Sometimes it's quite interesting. Hones my critical brain. Also, they tend to be dumb. They're a good lunchtime game in that way as well. Singularity is going to be a dumb game. I'm looking forward to playing dumb games.
But you'll never finish these games, so that's the problem.
No, I never finish them.
The full dumb. You'll only see partial dumb.
Yeah,
a glimpse of the dumb. So much that exists.
Fucking take is the draw. Some of these. a long way through Darksiders 2 again. Like, I started playing it because I was just desperate for Bloodborne. And that makes no sense. Oh, I'm logically,
it's so sad.
It's like a heroin addict just kind of eating sherbet. it's not the same thing. I know it's not. But I just started from shoveling into my gob.
It's like your gran's gone to the store to get you Bloodborne with only a little loose sense of what it is. Yeah. And tried to describe it to the person who walked in the store.
And she's come back with a dip down.
I was like, well, I'll snort this. Got to do something.
Mm. That's all the snorting we have time for. If you'd like to
snort more questions,
snort us a question, Marty.
You can do that by sending us an email to questions at Crane Crowbar. Or you can send us a tweet at Crate and Crowbar. Or you can contact us on the forums, which are crateandcrowbar.com/forums. Forum?
No, it's just forum singular.
Oh, you should go on to the forum, because one of our listeners has made a fantastic cryptic crossword about video games.
Crate and Crowbar cryptic crossword.
It's good, it's challenging.
Very good. I'm really bad at cryptic crosswords, so I'm taking other people's word on the fact that it's good.
It is good.
I like it.
You can also contact us individually on Twitter. I'm at Marsh Davis.
I am at Gonnas, G-O-N-N-A-S.
I'm at C. Thurston, spelled with an E.
I'm at PCG Ludo, L-U-D-O.
Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Hey!
Okay. What?
We had a little on his face.
I'm drunk. Yeah.